Hi, this is Mark Graben here. Today we have a special presentation for you. One of the other podcasts that I host is something I started in September called My Favorite Mistake. And last week I had Kinexus CEO Dr. Greg Jacobson as a guest on the podcast. So we thought we would share that episode and cross-post it here. So the full audio of that podcast will follow. And if you like this podcast and you're interested in subscribing, you can go to www.myfavoritemistake.com. Clint Corley from Kinexus is going to be a guest in the coming months, and you might hear other Kinexus voices on My Favorite Mistake. But again, here is our very own Dr. Greg Jacobson. Episode 31, Dr. Greg Jacobson, CEO of Kinexus.
Maybe one of the mistakes I had, which was trying to pick one of my favorite mistakes.
I'm Mark Graben. This is My Favorite Mistake. In this podcast, you'll hear business leaders and other really interesting people talking about their favorite mistakes. Because we all make mistakes. But what matters is learning from our mistakes instead of repeating them over and over again. So this is the place for honest reflection and conversation, personal growth, and professional success. Visit our website at myfavoritemistakepodcast.com. It would be a mistake to not enter to win a free My Favorite Mistake coffee mug. Go to markgraben.com/mistake31. And now, on with the show. Hi, welcome to My Favorite Mistake. I'm Mark Graben, and we're joined today by Dr. Greg Jacobson. He is an emergency medicine physician. He's also the co-founder and the CEO of the technology company Kinexus. Greg, thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm great, Mark. Thanks for having me on. As someone you know that I wouldn't say loves identifying my mistakes, but certainly doesn't have a problem identifying my mistakes. And I'm also glad you gave me about a month to prepare so I could really think about all the different mistakes that maybe people could learn from.
Well, sure. And that's one of the themes of the podcast here is, you know, for one, we all make mistakes, but secondly, hopefully we learn from those mistakes. And so, you know, with that, and there's a lot of other things we can explore afterwards. Greg, I mean, what would you say is your favorite mistake?
Favorite mistakes. That was maybe one of the mistakes I had, which was trying to pick one of my favorite mistakes. So I love the number five, and in kind of thinking through and identifying, I thought mistakes that were applicable to more people, because I think there's some mistakes that are going to be, you know, so unique to your personal situation that while hopefully you learn from them, they're probably not beneficial for other people. And really, we're doing this so other people can learn from these. So I broke it down to five, and perhaps they are in order. So mistake number one is not reading more. I used to be someone that really disliked reading. I didn't read very much in elementary school, middle school, high school. Obviously, I had to excel in academia, otherwise you can't get to medical school, but it felt like more of a chore. And what's interesting is that, before I say if someone would have told me, I'll just kind of go through the entire arc. There was a semester in college where I went and lived in Costa Rica, and there I ended up reading for some reason. I really got into a whole bunch of John Irving books and was reading just a lot of his novels. And someone even commented to me that, wow, your writing on your emails has improved so much. Mm-hmm. So to me, there was this disconnect between reading and all of the other benefits that reading does for you. I always thought reading was just a singular beneficial aspect of, well, you're just reading for information. I never ended up realizing that, well, the more you read, the faster you read, the more you comprehend what you're reading. And ultimately, the more it translates into writing. What's interesting is that if someone would have told me back in middle school, the single most valuable thing you can do in your life is to read, because it will make you, you know, smarter, more efficient, a better communicator. One, I probably wouldn't have believed them. But two, I feel like I would have had such a a leap ahead in so many areas that I've struggled in the past. And then I'll just pause to get your insight in this after. Mm-hmm. As time has gone on and as I've realized the benefit of reading, audiobooks have become much more popular. And while I think it's probably better to read, I find that I'm able to consume so much more with podcasts and audiobooks. And then in this year, we declared at Kynexus and that this is going to be the year of reading. And I'm realizing now we're 8 months into it, Mark, and it's not going to be the year of reading. It's just weird that we are going to have a culture of reading. And so we've done a number of different books in like book club format that we're all getting benefit from. So reading more. Yeah. In short.
Let's explore that a little bit. I recently had the chance to interview Tom Peters, kind of the legendary author of In Search of Excellence and other books. And I don't think he was just saying this because he's an author. He's saying that the biggest fault of a corporate CEO is that they don't read enough. And he really puts a huge emphasis on that, of basically the curiosity and the continued learning, in addition to the benefits that that you describe. So as a follow-up to that, I mean, I guess how and when did you realize, I mean, you sort of talked about how you got into reading, but when was it that you realized that it had been a mistake to not be reading as much in the past? How did you come to that?
Certainly when my good friend responded, I mean, this would have been in 96 that I was in Costa Rica. So email was newish. And he responded to the email and said, I can tell you've been reading a lot better because I can actually understand what you're writing. And then if there's one way to make someone really hate reading, it's to send them through medical school because you just have to read so much. And so between medical school and residency, my pleasure reading just really dropped off. And then it really came back with the founding of Kynexus and realizing I didn't have a formal business education. And so starting to read about startups and general business books, you know, probably read 50 over the last 15 years. And I've had people tell me, oh, well, you don't need to do an MBA because you've already read all of the major texts that you would review in an MBA anyway. So the switch has been getting extremely interested in spreading continuous improvement with Kynexus, which I know we'll talk about at the end. And so, but one other tip that I found really interesting that I just started doing with the book club, because we're not picking random books, right? We're picking books that we really think are beneficial. So I've ended up listening to them on audiobook, and then I've ended up purchasing the physical copy and re-listening to it on audiobook while I'm physically reading the text. Mm-hmm. And I have just had a huge deeper appreciation as well as extraction of information by doing that. So certainly worth an experiment for someone if they find themselves not being engaged or spacing out when they're either doing the audiobook or the physical book, just combine them. It's really hard to think about anything else when you're that engaged in mm-hmm. someone's words.
Yeah. So you talked about the mistake of not reading enough as a discovery. Thanks to your friend. What were some of the other favorite mistakes that had come to mind?
So number two was not figuring out a good work-life balance. And so I am a consummate workaholic, as I'm sure many people that are listening to this podcast are. And really once medical school was going, there was a period of time where I didn't think I wanted to be a doctor. I didn't enjoy the academic part of medical school at all. It was, in my opinion, completely devoid of intellect. It was just a process of how much can you possibly memorize and stick in your head. And so I got involved in real estate on the side because my parents were an entrepreneurial family, and my father has been in real estate for, you know, 50 plus years. And so while I got more interested in medicine when we started doing clinicals and seeing patients, my love of real estate never went away. So in the background, I've been investing in real estate over the last 20 plus years. And so that added a group of work. And then, you know, I had the brilliant idea, well, how hard could it be to start a software company? So I've been doing that as well as maintaining a clinical emergency medicine practice, although that's pretty tiny now. But in 2015, my wife sent me an email, and she said, if ever there's a time you could work less, please do so, because I feel like we are just co-inhabiting now versus having a meaningful relationship. And I'm summarizing
kind of wake
a much longer, yeah, a much longer email, but that email was really, it was amazing for me to get. And it's one of those emails I actually just return to my inbox every 90 days and I reread. Because the only way to establish work-life balance is to make tiny little choices where you're deciding, well, if I was someone that had a good work-life balance, what's the decision I would make right now? Would I unplug and go be with family? Would I pick up the guitar? Would I, you know, do projects around that? Whatever it is that's not working. And so it's something that I struggle with constantly. It's something that I've gotten better at over the last 5 years, because I will ask her maybe once a year, how am I doing? But it's something that I think that it's not intuitive, but you actually do better work when you're working, when you do have a good work-life balance. And so sometimes just putting more time, effort, and energy to something, it almost slows you down in a weird, bizarre way.
Well, there's, I mean, it seems like a lot of entrepreneurs and even CEOs in large corporations kind of perpetuate this idea that you can just effort your way out of anything, you know, kind of the culture of bragging about how many hours you work every week, or the executive profile of, well, so-and-so wakes up at 4 a.m. every morning and they're in the gym by 4:15. And, That's not the only way to really drive effectiveness, right?
Yeah, I think I would hate to jump to the conclusion that someone that said, "Oh, I wake up every morning at 4 a.m. and I'm in the gym by 4:15," to say that they don't have a good work-life balance. But I think a person only really knows themselves if they truly are aware and meaningfully introspective at whether or not they are achieving a work-life balance. Hopefully that process includes asking all the people that are most meaningful to them, hey, am I meeting your needs in this relationship? Am I present? Am I, you know, watching life pass by? But at the end of the day, it's just going to take looking at yourself in the mirror and figuring that out.
So you said you had three other mistakes.
Okay, three other. All right. So one of the things that happens in a startup, and it happened to us perfectly, is that, and it's something that I actually read. I wish I remember. I read a blog post on it, and I was like, oh, that fits us about 90%. Is you get to a certain point in a startup where the founder passion becomes diffused through so much interaction that you can't drive culture through just being passionate about solving a problem. So what do I mean? So we have two founders at Kinexus, Matt and I, and if we have our first two employees, you know, really got a ton of our attention. They were interacting with us, you know, certainly on a daily basis, but many times, you know, for many, many, many hours a day. You know, as you go from, you know, two employees to five employees to 10 to 15, you can start to understand the exponential growth aspect of that. And you start realizing, well, so now you have 100% of my time. Now this person might have 80% of my time. And this person, you get to a point where people are really getting a very small percent of your direct one-on-one. And so there needs, and it seems like 20 people is what this blog post that I was reading. I wish I could attribute it to the right person, but it seems like 20 seems to be a good number to realize that you need to start managing the company a little bit differently. And you need to go from kind of flying by the seat of your pants, shooting from the hip, to being more intentional about the type of people you want to be, or you know, people use the term culture. And so I have a recurring item on my to-do that reminds me that I should be spending about 20% of my time working on, I'm going to call them soft things, but that's not to say that they're less important than hard things. Right. And, you know, it's like the soft sciences are, you know, potentially more valuable than the hard sciences to us. But I'm labeling them as soft because you sometimes don't see a direct effect from them to the bottom line, for instance, like you would closing a deal or signing a renewal or expanding a customer. But they directly affect people's amount of joy they have at work. It's going to affect your retention. We had an incredibly high retention level at Kynexus, and the first person that just left was right about the 20-person mark. And sometimes people leave because they decide they no longer, you know, want to do that job and want to change careers. And sometimes they leave for other companies. But if you don't take the opportunity to say, well, what could I have done differently to make that person, you know, not want to make that decision, then, you know, shame on you for not using the opportunity. So focusing on culture. And then this next one, it's the yin, maybe not the yin to the yang, but it flows right off the tongue right after the focusing on culture, is focusing on appreciation. And growing up in an emergency medicine framework, you don't have really direct connection to your medical director all the time. And so you're kind of a solo person that a lot of people don't really see what you're doing on the front line with a patient. And so I never really appreciated how important appreciation is from your boss or the person that you report to. I mean, the emails that say, oh, it's Doctor Appreciation Day, or there's balloons, or they give you a gift. You know, those are great, but that's not the type of appreciation that we're talking about. We're talking about just meaningful. Hey, Mark, thanks for doing such a great job with, you know, the webinar series at Kynexus. Thank you for, you know, really adding value to Kynexus over the last 9 years and giving examples. I think is something that I'm learning. I'm trying to get better at. And I think that is hugely important in a company, especially when you kind of get past that 20 employee mark.
So, and before you talk about the fifth, I've got to ask. Okay. So you said, okay, your third mistake, maybe to paraphrase it back, was not learning soon enough how to be more scalable as the CEO, how to influence a larger company. And then you said not being appreciative enough. Is there a pattern? You said your first two were sort of the eye opener was an email from somebody.
Oh, interesting.
Did your third and fourth mistakes sort of come to light because of feedback, whether it was an email or
yes. Otherwise? Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. So we realized a couple of years ago when we started to focus on culture in a more meaningful way. So what does it mean to focus on culture? So it means to be more intentional about doing one-on-ones with people. It means to stop and really realize that people are people and they have home lives, and showing an interest, a genuine interest, not like a superficial interest, about people's passions and about, you know, what makes them tick outside of work. There's many other ones, but I'll just jump to the one where we got the feedback that I realized that I could probably be better at telling people, wow, that was really great work. Thanks for doing that. So we started a reverse evaluation process in the summer of 2019 was the first time we did it. We realized we had done regular, I guess, forward evaluations.
Just typical performance evaluation.
Performance evaluations we usually do it around January of every year, kind of talking about the prior year and things of that nature. But we never gave an opportunity for employees to evaluate the people they report to. So we did a bunch of research on how to do that. And we came up with a process where it's anonymous. And I'm very big on anonymity, or big on not being anonymous when you're engaging in improvement work. And that's probably a topic for a different podcast. But we felt like doing it in a way where people could get feedback, where they didn't fear any repercussions from that. And so it gets sent to someone outside of Kinexus, and that person kind of removes personalizations without trying to make it too diluted, and kind of gives it back to us. And in both evaluations, in 2019 and 2020, it was a theme that people feel like they don't get appreciated. And so appreciation has to be from the perspective of the person that is receiving it, because that's why you're giving it, for them. So I could say, well, I feel like I give people appreciation all the time, but if people don't feel like they're appreciated, it doesn't really matter what I feel in that situation. So so it was through the written word.
Yeah. Well, and when you talk about giving that direct, specific, individualized feedback and recognition, it being powerful, that makes me think of, one of my favorite business leaders, the late Paul O'Neill, who said, in an excellent organization, people would be able to answer yes to three questions every day. And that third question is, have I received recognition? And here's the important part. I think you'll get a kick out of this. Have I received recognition from somebody whose opinion matters to me? Which I think is an interesting thing.
Yeah, interesting.
Tacks on. And I'm not saying that people aren't respecting, it doesn't matter that they're getting feedback from you, but I think that's an interesting dimension to think about, where I think that generic, it makes me think of that generic of like, oh, it's Nurses Appreciation Week and we're throwing a pizza party. Does that really count as recognition? And if that chief nursing officer, who maybe you've never seen all year, suddenly shows up and has some platitudes, does that really provide?
Yeah, I'm sure it moves the needle, but it's not moving the needle, I think, in a meaningful way that people think it's moving the needle. It would just mean so much more when the chief nursing officer walks down on a busy ER shift and just says, hey, thanks so much, we got three pizzas coming later. That I think is more meaningful than the, oh, it's whatever the nursing appreciation or the doctor appreciation day happens to be on the calendar.
Recognition can also mean acknowledgement of, I'm here and I'm not just dropping off the pizzas, but I've got some time if you want to tell me how things are going here and what could we be doing better. Those are conversations that you and Kinexus and the customers are always talking about improvement. Recognition can be different things, or maybe I'm just using the word.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to say that you should drop off pizzas.
Yeah.
I think the 90% of the benefit there is just coming down and looking at someone in the eyes and say, dude, I get it. Like, this is, this is where the real work is happening and we really appreciate it. And yeah, I know it can get overwhelming sometimes. So, but pizzas are always great too.
Yeah. And my point was, if that chief nursing officer only shows up once a year in that ceremonial, hey, it's Nurses Week, that they might not, that person's opinion or recognition might not matter. They don't know that person. They don't have a relationship with them.
Right.
That's what you're saying, in a company of 20 people or less, even though that's evolved, as you described, people can have more of a relationship with you as the CEO than they could be with hundreds or thousands of nurses in an organization.
Yeah. So if I was thinking about scaling this, obviously when we have 40 people that are part of the Kinexus team and then 100 and so on and so forth, there's going to come a time where I won't be part of the hiring process. I have never worked with someone directly on something. So I would need to think of some process where, I'm getting feedback or I'm hearing about things that are happening several levels different from me, where I can call someone out with some, specific example. And obviously, if there's 1,000 people, I won't be able to do that to everybody. But if I could do that to, 20 people throughout the year, and then I'm showing that as modeling behavior, then presumably everyone's going to get get some appreciation or love from their bosses. And I think that probably that doesn't feel like a very difficult process to develop. It just feels like you need to have the desire to do that, because a quick 3-line email, I mean, what does it take you a couple minutes to write? So.
Okay. And then what was the fifth of your top five most favorite?
So this is an interesting one, and maybe it's flipping it a little bit on your head or the question on its head, but I've made mistakes in the past, and sorry for the extra noise. We're all working from home. So I've made mistakes in the past like some real estate. I'll use real estate for an example, because that's just an easy one to kind of, I've made some investments in real estate without doing my proper due diligence, because I made the assumption, oh, well, this person is investing in that, and they have a good track record and they're a smart person. So by proxy, I don't need to do as much due diligence. And if you look back at all of the investments I've made that have not done as well, fortunately, I have more that have done well than not. But if you look back at that, that's a recurring theme that happens. And so I think that the teaching point for me is that I don't make the assumption that other people know more than you or know better than you. That doesn't mean you should always make the assumption that you're right and they're wrong, but don't go in with that default assumption. And so I think that's the real tricky part is how do you know when to listen to yourself or when to listen to someone else? And if everyone knew that, then you know, we'd always make the right decisions, because then we just ask around and know, oh, well, that's the right thing to do. But I think you get my point that do a little bit of your own research. Don't aimlessly follow, if that makes sense.
Okay. So let's talk, and thank you for sharing all of that and for those reflections. Let's talk a little bit about Kynexus, and maybe have you describe, you know, what the company's mission is and what the products and services are. But then, you know, also, you know, would be curious to know, as CEO, how do you work at building a culture where people aren't afraid to admit mistakes? And how do you create a culture where people are learning from mistakes? Because again, mistakes happen.
So I'll touch on those two things, but before I touch on those two things, I want to add one thing that has gotten Kynexus to where it is today. And so when we're thinking about mistakes, or really decisions, because we're talking about, you know, decisions we made or actions we did, that's really what the mistake is. It's probably not just a pure thought experiment that would determine a mistake, is that in reality, if you look back at the arc of Kynexus, the 5 years kind of pre-company formation where I was thinking about the concepts and working on a prototype software, and then the 10 years now of being in the company arena, there might be only 5 or 10 real decisions that would have completely impacted the company to the point of failure. The other, I probably am participating in a dozen or two dozen decisions a day, and depending on how important you're talking about it, it might be that a person is making, you know, hundreds of decisions a day down, if we're talking about like, well, what are you going to have for breakfast? But the vast majority of decisions that you make in a day or in a business really aren't going to change the bottom line in a meaningful way. You just have to get like 80% of them right. So the real thing is knowing, is this a decision that could have the potential to kill the company, versus is this a decision that doesn't have that potential, so the risk of failure is one, mitigated because the impact isn't necessarily detrimental, but two, is going to be also impacted in a positive way, because you're going to be observant about the failure and you're going to improve from it. And so as I'm thinking about, you know, delegating decisions to people, that crosses my mind. You know, if Mark makes this decision and he's wrong, how detrimental is it? And so, so kind of as we're thinking through decisions and mistakes, there's probably maybe one or two a year that are the really big ones. And then there's, you know, 99% of the other ones, you need to get most of them right. You just don't need to get all of them right. Obviously, if 100% of the decisions you make are mistakes, you're going to run a company into the ground or an organization into the ground. So I wanted to say that, and it dovetails nicely that we are a startup that is still around. And so I would argue that we have not made any fatal mistakes, and that we've, for the most part, made more correct answers than incorrect answers. And so we're a software company. We help organizations spread a culture of continuous improvement. And so most people that are listening to this know you are I'll call you a lean guru. And so most of our customers are coming from, I know you're smirking and you're nodding.
That's a mistake using that word. Go ahead. That's a mistake.
But most people that know you wouldn't find it surprising that you're working with a software company that is implementing, you know, continuous improvement, lean and Kaizen concepts, or at least helping organizations implement those. And so that's what we do. We have companies that come to us and say, we are totally disorganized. We have no way to understand impact. We have no way to engage our employees. We're using Excel, Word. We're using these project management platforms that aren't based on lean and Kaizen concepts. We need to accelerate how many ideas we get. So those are the kinds of things that people come to us, and we provide a platform to help people manage their top-down work, like large-scale lean projects that might have 10 to 20 people involved in them that might last for months. And people sometimes call them value stream maps or large PDSAs or strategic A3s, or kind of give it a bunch of different names. We also help people manage their their bottom up work. That's, you know, employee frontline ideas, opportunities for improvement, frustrations, identifications of defects or mistakes, or patient errors, something that's driven from the frontline. And then it gets routed kind of up through. We help people visualize their KPIs, and hopefully if they're measuring the right KPIs and they're doing good improvement work, then those key performance indicators will be improving. And then finally, as we've evolved, because we really started initially with just bottom up, and then we added the top down, and then we added the KPIs, but we realized people were coming to us and saying, this is all great, but we need a way to align it all. Mm-hmm. And so we've added in functionality into the platform that helps people with their strategy deployment or their Hoshin work, so they can see how do the KPIs, how do the big initiatives, and how do all the small initiatives kind of fit together. I guess I should have probably gone vertical there instead of horizontal. So, but that's a little bit about Kinexus. So if you are trying to develop a culture of continuous improvement and you're struggling, and you realize you're probably not using the right technologies, then that you would be a good person to reach out to us and see if we can help with those things.
Yeah. And the website there is kinexus.com, KAINEXUS.com. Boy, I made a mistake and stumbled through the spelling of that. Kinexus.com.
No, I'm glad you, I think you went slow. I like that. Right. And it's obviously a combination of the words Kaizen and Nexus. So yeah. The idea is that you would do continuous improvement kind of in an interconnected way at an organization. And I'm proud to say that Mark and I met on Valentine's Day of 2011. Yeah. And he has been a part of the company since its early days. I like to think of him as keeping us on track to the mission and the I'm going to use quotes again, air quotes, the correct application of lean practices. And so we're honored to have had you part of the team.
Well, thanks. And so, yeah, I was going to say, in the interest of disclosure, that I've been a contractor, a part-time employee, an investor, part of the team at Kinexus in different ways. But one observation, and going back to 2011, 2012, we talked about this a lot, Greg, of being intentional around the culture. And one thing I'll give you and Matt as the other co-founder credit for, as the day-to-day leaders of the organization, is creating an environment where people aren't blamed or vilified when something goes wrong, because as you have experienced differently than I have around healthcare, when people get named, blamed, and shamed, when a mistake occurs, that leads to the hiding of problems. And then if you cover up the problem, you can't learn from it as an individual, as a leader, as an organization. So the one thing that comes to mind, answering my own question a little bit, of how do you create a culture where people are learning from mistakes? I think it comes back to the idea of eliminating fear, eliminating blame, and creating an environment where, yes, we can reflect, but we've got to do so in a way that's constructive instead of just beating ourselves up, or even worse, beating someone else up in a proverbial sense.
I think, and you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong on who kind of uses the 85 to 15 rule, but if you go into something that 85% of defects or errors are based on a inadequate process, and only 15% of those are based on true human error, you end up creating a culture. And I've worked in cultures in the past, especially on the healthcare, where the burden of identifying an error, there is shame associated with it. And there is sometimes such a rigorous process that you are going to get involved, that if there was no harm that happened, 9 times out of 10, it's just not going to get reported. And any physician, nurse, anyone that actually does clinical medicine, will nod their head up and down. I mean, I've worked in over a dozen medical centers over the last 20 years in different countries. And it's just, and I'm talking about the small stuff, like, oh, person got 600 Motrin instead of 800 Motrin. Well, I mean, that's really an opportunity for improvement, but right. You know, not having a system that makes that easy and celebrates that experience, not because we're happy someone got 200 milligrams less than they should have gotten, but because they provided an opportunity to look at a process to see if we could make that safer, because, you know, the next medication error could be, you know, 10x of the amount of heparin that someone is given. And, you know, heparin, as you know, is a blood thinning medication, and that can be and has been life threatening. And that mistake may have been prevented. I don't know, you know, how many times this happened, but I know you and I both know of the specific case that we're thinking about. But that may have been prevented had there been a different culture and a much smaller in impact error was made. That had there been a process to evaluate that, it could have prevented other things. And so, I've just this past couple of days, we did a retrospective, as we do with every release, and that we did a release on Friday, or two Fridays ago, and the dev team, product team, all get together, and I'm so proud of that team. The quality of the work that they do is so high. And even though they do that level of quality, they also are looking for ways to improve. And so it is a pleasure when you work in that framework that we don't want to over process things, but we're going to focus on process to see if we can eliminate mistakes in the past or mistakes in the future. I'd like to think we do a good job of it.
Yeah. Well, it's an ongoing effort and challenge, and that reflection leads to growth, which leads to more likelihood of success, I think. So, and that's why.
Thank you very much. I will be appreciative of your appreciation.
Sure. And that's why, you know, we call the podcast My Favorite Mistake. It's not titled Beat Yourself Up Over Something that You Did. So thank exactly. you, Greg, for leading by example and for talking about mistakes, and more importantly, the learning that comes from those. So I am appreciative of our guest. He's Dr. Greg Jacobson, again, emergency medicine physician, co-founder, CEO of Kynexus. Greg, thank you. Thank you so much for being a guest.
Thank you very much for having me, Mark. And I always like to remind people that there is no better day than today to start working on continuous improvement, whether that's personally or whether that's at your organization. What you do matters. And so just get to it. And best of luck.
Yeah. Thanks, Greg. Thanks for listening. I hope this podcast inspires you to pause and think about your own favorite mistake and how learning from mistakes shapes you personally and professionally. If you're a leader, what can you do to create a culture where it's safe for colleagues to talk openly about mistakes in the spirit of learning? Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. Our website is myfavoritemistakepodcast.com. See you next time.